I'm going to welcome you to week six now of our series called I Am, where we're looking at all seven of the I Am statements of Jesus. This series is rapidly coming to a close. It's going to culminate on Easter, where you heard during announcements we have 30 as of right now. I'm sure more people just got signed up, but as of right now, we, to my knowledge, have 36 people signed up to get baptized. Unreal. I have no. I don't even have a category for something like that. So we're in week six. We're looking at how Jesus defined himself in John chapter 15. I'm going to start in verse 1. It says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vineyard keeper. Every branch in me that does not produce fruit, he removes, and he prunes every branch that produces fruit so that it'll produce more fruit. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I in you. Just as a branch is unable to produce fruit by itself unless it remains on the vine, so neither can you unless you remain in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. The one who remains in me and I in him produces much fruit because you can do nothing without me. If anyone does not remain in me, he's thrown aside like a branch and he withers. They gather them, throw them into the fire, and they're burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you want and it'll be done for you. Y'all hear that? My Father is glorified by this, that you produce much fruit and prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. That's an amazing statement right there. Remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I've kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. And we'll end here in verse 11. It says, I have spoken these things to you so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. This is God's word. In this I am statement, Jesus calls himself, if you notice at the top, not just the vine, but the true vine. And the reason that he did that was because there was another vine that was mentioned all throughout scriptures that the original recipients of this little passage would have immediately known about. The imagery of a vine is used all throughout the Old Testament to refer to one specific group of people, and that group of people is known as the nation of Israel. But what's interesting is that time and time again in the Old Testament, when Israel is referred to as a vine, it's in a negative sense. You can see this probably more than a dozen different ways. I just want to read you one passage from Isaiah chapter 5. He said in verse 1, he said, the one I love had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He's talking about God there. He said, the one I love, God, had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He broke up the soil, cleared it of stones, and planted it with the finest vines. He built a tower in the middle of it and even dug out a wine press there. And that's Isaiah talking about the incredible lengths that God went to develop health in the nation of Israel. All the things that he did for them and, you know, for their good. And it says he expected it. He expected this vine to yield good grapes, but it yielded worthless grapes. And in verse 7 it says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel and the men of Judah, the plant he delighted in. He looked for justice but saw injustice, for righteousness but heard cries of wretchedness. So when Jesus, you know, hundreds of years after Isaiah wrote those words, when Jesus arrived on planet Earth and he called himself the true vine here, what Jesus was saying is that he is able to do what Israel was never able to do. Jesus is able to do what you and I are never going to be able to do in and of our own power. And Jesus is able to do what only a healthy vine is able to do, which is to produce in a way that the first vine, Israel, could not. And so as Jesus, as the true vine, is capable not only of producing the fruit that God was always looking for in people but couldn't find it, in Jesus is able to cause us to produce things in our lives that would never otherwise be possible except for Jesus. And that's what this passage is really about. We're going to look at three things that Jesus produces in our lives that absolutely can't be possible apart from him. But before I get into what those three things are, I want to make a comment about this I am statement. When I go through a series like this one, where we're looking at I am statements held, you know, one after the other, held up next to each other, just the way that my mind works is I'm always looking for what the differences are between the statements. And obviously there's the difference, you know, there's the superficial difference that Jesus identifies himself in seven different ways, but there's a lot deeper differences in each one of these passages, where these passages, they serve unique purposes and do unique things. For instance, If you were here for week one of this series when we talked about the bread of life, what we said was that statement means that Jesus came to satisfy us. But in that passage, Jesus is not just telling us that he came to satisfy us, he's showing us needs that you and I are designed by God with, and how he meets each one of those needs. So it's as much a commentary about our needs as it is his ability to meet them. What's so unique about this statement, and I'll put a maybe in front of this, is that this passage is maybe better than any other single passage in the entire Bible at showing you and I what it means to grow in your relationship with Jesus. A lot of people have a lot of ideas about what a Christian should be or should look like. A lot of people try to reduce Christianity to, you know, people that try to do good things and try not to do bad things. And a lot of people talk about maturity like it means going to a meeting 52 times a year or cussing less or something like that. But what this passage is a litmus test. And as we talk about these points, if you've already given your life to Jesus, the greatest way to know where you're at as far as growing or regressing in your relationship with Jesus is to ask yourself, are you seeing more of what we're talking about this morning in your life than you used to? Because what Jesus is saying here is, this is what it looks like if you're connected to me. Now, if you're here and you have not given your life to Jesus, you could not have picked a better morning to join us, because this is going to give you all the information you need to know about what it means to have a relationship with Jesus, and why it's worth it or not worth it to do so. Because Jesus is just very plainly making promises about what he can produce in people's lives who give their lives to him. And so what does Jesus produce in us is the question we're asking. The 3 points today are going to be the answers to that. And we'll start with my first answer to that question, the first idea today. It's that the true vine produces deep change in us. That's what Jesus does. In verse 5, here's what he says. He says, I am the vine, you are the branches. The one who remains in me and I in him produces much fruit, because you can do nothing without me. So the metaphor that Jesus is going to constantly refer to here is a metaphor in which he's the vine and we're the branches, which, you know, in Jesus' day, you readily grasp that because you saw vineyards wherever you went. In our day, you know, we're a little bit removed from that, so it's worth kind of unpacking a little bit. In Jesus' day, when you planted a vineyard, there was one main vine that ran throughout the vineyard that really determined the health and the growth and the life of the entire vineyard. And that vine, it didn't necessarily produce fruit in and of itself, but it was responsible for every piece of fruit that was produced, every grape that was produced, because the health and the life of that vine determined the health and the life and the ability of the branches that connected to it to produce. And so if that vine was healthy, then those branches would produce all kinds of fruit. But no matter how great those branches were in and of themselves, what was impossible was for a branch to produce any fruit at all if it was not connected to that vine. And so Jesus is saying two things in verse 5 here. He's saying, first off, that if we're connected to him, we can produce much fruit, all right? Fruit for days. But what he's saying by antithesis there is that if we're not connected to him, it's not just that we'll be less productive than we otherwise could be. He's saying that apart from him, we can't produce anything at all. Apart from him, we can do nothing. Now, if I was showing up to church for the first time today, the first question I would have is, what on earth does it mean that apart from Jesus, I can do nothing? And that's the first question I had when I read this myself. And so that's where I want to start. When Jesus says, apart from him, we can do nothing, obviously, there are lots of things that we can do apart from a relationship with Jesus that are morally good things to do, okay? Whether or not you have a relationship with Jesus, you can give money to charity, you can help a person who's homeless, cut your neighbor's lawn, great. But the one thing the Bible teaches that you and I cannot do apart from a relationship with Jesus is please God. And the reason for that is very simple. It's because we do not have the ability to change our own hearts, okay? What we can do, we can definitely modify our own behavior. We just can't control anything that goes beneath our behavior. Let me put it this way. Somebody in the house of God this morning is going to clock into work tomorrow and get a case of the Mondays, okay? And maybe this is going to turn out to be a prophecy. Maybe one of us is going to show up to work tomorrow and have a coworker pop off at the mouth and tell you a whole lot of things you're not prepared to hear on a Monday morning. Here's the thing. You can, through sheer willpower, physically restrain yourself from punching said coworker in the face, and I hope you do. What you can't do is What you can't control is your burning desire to punch them in the face. Okay, fair? Like you might be able to get to the point where you master controlling your impulses. You just can't change the impulses themselves, the anger, the bitterness, the all of that rot that exists inside of you. And that's exactly what Jesus is talking about here. He's talking about everything in our life that exists beneath our surface level behaviors that we really can't just decide to change. Things like our motives, things like our intentions, things like our desires, really everything that emanates from our heart. Because regardless of what we do, you and I cannot simply decide to change our hearts. And this idea is something that I feel like God began to show me in actually a really painful way a few years ago. Because a couple years ago, I decided to do something different. I just felt like I needed to kind of change things up in my walk with God. And so I decided to start the year in a book called The Songs of Jesus, written by a guy named Tim Keller. And it's a year-long devotional through the Psalms, and it's nice because it breaks the Psalms into 365 pieces, so they're little bite-sized pieces, and I would read that and kind of, you know, try to really think on that and figure out what that meant and talk to God about it. And that would be my time that I would spend with God in the morning. And so what the author does is he recommends, just to kind of help you get into the text, is that you write down, after you read the passage, three words: adore, admit, and aspire. And so you take whatever the passage is and you write down what you adore about God that passage revealed, that maybe you never saw, or you know, you see in a little bit of a different light now. You write that down. And then you write down what you admit, something that passage exposes in you that's an area of weakness, an area that you realize you need to grow in. You know, you jot that down. And then you write down something that you aspire to see change in your life as a result of what you read that day. And it takes a little bit of, I mean, it's not a surface level thing. It really does help you get into the text. So I would read and I would ask those three questions and I'd come up with my answers. And I would basically just take what I wrote down and I talk to God about it. And I try to, you know, just sit and be quiet before God and listen to God about it, which is, just because of my nature, one of the hardest things, one of the least developed disciplines in my life is just sitting and listening and doing nothing. Anyway, I did this, I think it was like 2016. I did this, I was about three, maybe 4 months into the year, didn't really know what to expect from this process, didn't really know what I was getting myself into, and sure enough, after about 3-4 months, I had realized that I had only realized one thing. After about 4 months of doing this, going out of my way to be super holy Pastor Ryan, God had really just revealed one thing to me, and it was a painful thing to realize, and you're all on the edge of your seat, I'm sure, so I'll just tell you. It's that I needed God to change me a lot more than I thought I did 4 months prior. And that's a kind of, what the heck does that mean kind of statement, so I'm going to get real honest and just let you into my walk with God. What I realized some 4 months into deliberately pursuing God in a new way via, you know, reading and prayer and meditation, all that stuff, what I realized is that my motives, even for doing the right things, were just shot. And I guess I knew this before, but it's not fun when you really, you know, there's a difference between knowing something conceptually and experientially, right? It's kind of when it moves from your head to your heart. Because here's the reality of spending time with God. It's a great thing to do, but you can do it for a lot of wrong reasons. Like you can spend time with God just because it makes you feel good about yourself. Now you can feel like a, you know, a Dudley Do-Right good person that day, and you can even look down on people that aren't as spiritual and righteous as you. I mean, it's a good thing you're spending time with God. You're just doing it for a terrible reason. Right? Another reason that's, I feel like, really common that people can spend time with God, I'm speaking from personal experience here too, is because you just hope God will get you out of a situation that you shouldn't have got yourself into in the first place. Come on, somebody. Has somebody been there before? Thank you. Yeah, and so the end of that quiet time sounds like a prayer that goes, God, I know I shouldn't have done it, but I did it. If you get me out of it, I won't do it again, right? That has never honored God, just so we're clear. But what I realized some 4 months into this process is I was primarily spending time with God because I knew that doing so would make me a better husband to my wife, Katie, a better father to my kids, and a better pastor to this church. Now, don't get me wrong, those are great things to desire. Those are godly things to desire. But if that's the primary reason that you're spending time with God, as noble as that sounds, what's wrong with it is that every one of those motives had me at the center. And so basically what I realized is man, you're just networking God. You're using God as a means to an end, spending time with him because you know you're going to get something out of it. And I started thinking, what if I used that in any other relationship that I was in? Like what if somebody asked me why I married Katie and I said, oh, because I get a lot out of the relationship. You know, she makes it easier to pay my bills. I can afford a better quality of life. And she buys me stuff. You know, every couple of weeks I come home to a gleaming new sweater kind of thing, right? Terrible reason. That's the most shallow reason to get. I've taken baths deeper than those reasons. You know what I'm saying? And the reason that you get married is because, the right reason to get married is because you see who God has made this person and who God is making that person, and you just want to be a part of that, and you just love them for who they are. It's not about networking. It's not about what can I get out of it. That relationship's dead as soon as it's alive. It was never alive in the first place. But we forget that with God. And what I had realized was I had forgotten that with God. And I have a proclivity of continually forgetting that with God. But just so we're clear, you know, when Jesus said the first and greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, what he's saying is the only right time, the only right reason to spend time with God is because he's God, period. It's not about what we get out of him. It's about who he is. That's it. And so here I was a couple months into the year, and I felt like I had just gone backwards, and I'm, you know, it was demoralizing to me. I'm wondering what's going on in my life. I'm wondering, has anybody else ever felt this way? Am I alone? Is this from the enemy? Is this from God? Is this evidence of progress or regress? You know, what's up? And so I started talking to a friend of mine about this, you know, thankfully, he kind of pastored me through it, and what he helped me realize is that what I was experiencing ultimately is the point of spending time with God, because what he was revealing to me as our relationship went deeper and deeper is exactly what Jesus is saying here in John 15:5. What I was coming face to face with in a real experiential, albeit painful way for the first time in my life is that I can't do anything apart from Jesus because I can't change my own heart. It's one thing to realize that you're self-centered. It's another thing to realize I can't do anything about my self-centeredness. It's so deeply ingrained in me, I can't just decide to move myself out of the center of my own life. And what I realized in and through that process, it's actually only, and this is a little bit ironic, it's only when you come face to face with your own powerlessness to change your own heart that Jesus can begin to do it for you. Because when you really start to realize how bad the problem is, that it's well beyond your pay grade, when you start to realize how powerless you are to change your own heart, then you really start to realize how much you need grace. And when you start to realize how much you really need grace, that's when grace looks amazing again. And when grace looks amazing to us, when it really captivates us, when it really looks beautiful to us, when it really starts taking our breath away, that's when grace melts our heart, and that's when real change begins. And as I started, you know, just thinking about the whole of Scripture, what I saw is that that's how God operates with everybody that he decides to use. And matter of fact, God can't use you until he does that in you. You think about Isaiah the prophet. When he had his encounter with God, the very first thing he came to realize was how bad he was in light of how perfect this God is. He said, woe is me, I'm undone, for I'm a man of unclean lips. You know, when Peter on his boat on the Sea of Galilee stood before Jesus and recognized this is no ordinary rabbi, the very first utterance out of his mouth was, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. And the reality is, if we never get there, if we never see in light of God's perfect holiness how broken we are and powerless we are to change it, then all of our spirituality and all of our morality, it's really just a subtle form of pride. Because we'll go through life believing that we're just really good people, that have pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, that have produced a lot of good fruit in our lives by our own power. And we'll start to look down on other people that we perceive to be better than, and we'll start to get this, you know, kind of attitude toward God where, you know what, he's pretty lucky to have somebody like me around. And as a matter of fact, he kind of owes me a few blessings for how good I am. And this disgusting kind of arrogance and sense of entitlement begins to form in our life. And before you know it, what we've become is a Pharisee. We'll be so blind to our own pride, we won't realize we're literally drowning in it, which was the condition of the Pharisees. And, the thing about Pharisees is they were actually good people. What I mean by that is, you know, if you're listening to this as a small group leader, Pharisees are the kind of people that small group leaders hope show up on Wednesday nights because they don't cost you anything. Pharisees aren't going to call you at 2 a.m. because they're having a breakdown. Pharisees aren't going to confess any sort of, you know, ongoing deep sin that they really need your help walking through. I mean, Pharisees just didn't have a whole lot of open, outward, obvious, blatant sin in their life at all. And if there's ever a need, Pharisees are the first ones to sign up for it. Be that financial, be that a meal train, fill in the blank. You know, pastors love it when Pharisees come into their churches because they do whatever you ask of them. And if there's a work party, they come early, they stay late, they take no lunch. I got that little line from my dad. Come early, stay late, take no lunch. That's what Pharisees did. You know, regardless of what the economy's doing, Pharisees are going to find a way to the letter of the law. They'll tithe 10%. They'll do whatever you ask of them. They were very good people. I mean, frankly, they're a lot like what we hope our kids grow up to be. The only thing that Pharisees didn't grasp, the only thing that they didn't grasp was that none of what they did mattered without Jesus. And the thing about Christianity is if you grasp everything except that one thing, you've lost everything. Because Jesus is the whole thing. And so what Jesus is talking about here, and he's laying out what Christianity is. Being a follower of Jesus is not being a self-made individual. It's not being a try-hard. It's not being somebody that pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. Being a Christian is somebody who is just acutely aware of their desperate need of Jesus. That's what Christianity is. Yeah, we can do all kinds of good things in and of our own power, but our issue before God is not a works issue, it's a heart issue, and we can't change our own hearts. And with just this one statement, with just Jesus saying, apart from me, you can do nothing, that one statement right there is what sets Christianity just light years apart from the message of other religions or religion in general, because all religion rests on the premise that you are required to produce fruit for your God in and of your own power. Christianity begins by forcing you to realize that you depend on your God for the power to produce any fruit for him at all. And those are not two shades of the same idea. Those are radically different worldviews. That's what Jesus is saying here. And so it leaves us with the question, okay, so if we can't do anything apart from Jesus, what does it mean that if we abide in him, we can produce a lot of fruit? What Jesus is saying in the first half of verse 5, he is promising that in him, you and I can experience the growth that every single human being desperately longs to see in their own life. And I don't care what you believe, be it Christian, Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist, if you're into Shintoism, Taoism, Scientology, atheism, agnosticism, whatever it is, the kind of fruit that Jesus is promising we can produce in him is the fruit that every single one of us wants more of in our own life. The fruit is what's known as the fruit of the Spirit, and I just want to read it to you. I'm in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is, here it is, here's the fruit Jesus says we can produce in him. It's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faith, gentleness, and self-control. But before I move on from this, I'd like you to do something for me and just imagine you, but with more of those attributes in your life. Can we put it back up on the screen? I want you to picture you, but a more loving version of you. Think about what that would look like. All right, picture you, but instead of being, you know, negative, you have more joy. Imagine you, but with more peace and less anxiety. With more patience, instead of being angry all the time. With more kindness, less cruelty. Imagine a version of you where you just seem to emanate goodness instead of bitterness. You know, there's more faith and there's less doubt. There's more gentleness and there's less harshness. And your life would be characterized more by self-control and less by self-destruction. I've had the privilege of being a pastor now for just over 5 years. And in the 5 years that I've had the ability to do this, by far the most educational part of the job has been the time that I've gotten to spend with people in a one-on-one setting as they have gotten more honest in some cases than they ever had been anywhere else in their life. I've literally sat with people in my office where they have told me things that they've never told their parents, They've never told their siblings, and in some cases that they've never told themselves. They've never heard themselves say it. I consider that to be the greatest honor of pastoring. There is no greater honor than for somebody to trust me with that. And if that has taught me anything, it's that you never know. You never know what people are carrying around Sunday in and Sunday out. We are so good at putting this mask on and pretending like we're lily white and don't have any problems on Sunday morning, but man, is that a lie from the enemy. And if we all got honest about what was going on, I think everybody would take a nice, deep, relaxing breath. But I tell you what I've never seen in 5 years. No one has ever come into my office and said, "Pastor Ryan, you have got to help me. I'm at my wit's end. I am too loving to my wife and kids. I mean, our faces hurt from smiling. And I have so much peace in my life, even when things don't go my way. It's just, it's nauseating. I'm tired of getting 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep each night and waking up rejuvenated and refreshed and optimistic about the day's challenges. I can't take it anymore. Can you do something for me?" I would have no idea what to do with that lunatic. Okay, haven't experienced that in ministry. That'd be a curveball. That'd cause me to go back to the feet of Jesus to handle that one. But I tell you what I have experienced in 5 years. I've had people come in destroyed on the inside because they've done something that they swore they'd never do or they'd never do again. Because they've become someone that they promised themselves they'd never become. Because they've come to the painful realization that they are severely deficient in these fruits that Jesus said he can produce in our lives. I mean, I've sat with people that hate how unloving they are. And they give anything to flip a switch and change it. They hate how little peace and joy they experience in their life. They hate the decisions that they've made as a result of the total absence of self-control in their character. There's not a person in the world that doesn't want more of that. And what Jesus is saying is that he and he alone is the key to it. That he and he alone is capable of producing fruit in us that first and foremost is pleasing to God. But second to that is life-giving to the people that God has placed in our life. And it's the kind of fruit that we actually want to produce. And we don't get there by trying really hard to being a better version of ourselves, as important as effort is. That's not how you get there. We don't get there by reading another best-selling self-help book. As beneficial as those books can sometimes be, you get there by doing what a branch has to do to a vine. You simply connect to Jesus. That kind of change on the screen right now is not change you can do. It is only the byproduct of something that can be done in you, and the true vine is the only one that can do it. That's why a man named Scott Sauls said that we need to stop trying to be like Jesus and we need to start trying to be with him. Because the irony is that as we simply spend time with Jesus, we look up one day and we realize, I've become more like him. That's what Jesus is promising here, that the true vine produces deep change in us, change that we can't produce in and of ourselves. But that's not all that Jesus produces here. My second idea this morning is that the true vine produces right desires in us. And we see this in verse 7. Jesus said, "If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you want and it will be done for you." That's an amazing thing Jesus said there, because it sounds like he just wrote us a blank check to literally having any prayer answered. Right? He said very plainly there, ask whatever you want and it'll be done. But there's two conditions Jesus places on this promise here. First is that we remain in him, and secondly, that his words remain in us. And what Jesus is doing there is painting this picture of a constantly ever-deepening relationship with him. What Jesus means when he talks about remaining in him, he's talking about refusing to compartmentalize your relationship with Jesus. Every one of us wants to try to reduce our time with God to this 5-minute clip in the morning before we go about and do the things we have to do. Or we try to reduce our time with God to a 90-minute meeting once a week. But what Jesus is talking about here is realizing that all of life is just a walk with Jesus. He's always there. It's taking that into consideration in every season, every circumstance, every trial, every hardship, and it's constantly going back to Jesus for the source of strength when and not if we fail again. And when Jesus is talking about allowing his words to remain in us, basically he's saying letting God call the shots in our lives. Everybody lives according to some rule book, whether or not it's an actual rule book. Right? We're either going to be led by our own feelings. I don't know who that's ever worked out for. You know, or we're going to live by whatever culture says is truth this year, and I promise you it's going to change in less than 365 days, or we're going to live according to what God said is timelessly true. Jesus is saying here what it means to be a follower of him is to allow this book to be our roadmap for life. And Jesus says as that happens, as we develop this deepening relationship with Jesus, the byproduct is that we can ask whatever we want of God and it's going to be done for us. How on earth could Jesus say that? He said that because he knew something would happen. He knew that if we as people spend our lives in an ever-deepening relationship with Jesus and spend our lives allowing his word to shape the way that we live, something amazing would happen in our lives. Our desires themselves would change to the point that our desires become like God's desires. And so our will, what we ask God for, is his will. It's ultimately what's best for us anyway. For the last 2 years, I have made, and I think before I say things like this, long pause. For the last 2 years, I have made what may well be the worst mistake of my life. I did a juice cleanse. Show of hands, who's done a juice cleanse? Yeah. Yeah, brothers and sisters. When I say juice cleanse, they'll talk to me about smoothies with like ice cream in them or something. When I say juice cleanse, I mean I went out and bought me a juicer, a Breville, the Cadillac of juicers, I'm told, and I drank for 7 days. I didn't do nothing but drink cold fruit and vegetable juice. Put the fear of God in you. I got the idea from a documentary called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. You should check it out. It's on Netflix. Jokes aside, I'm a bit of a documentary connoisseur. I don't just throw out a recommendation. Watch the documentary. Change your life. And so for 7 days, I did this. And actually, the first time I did it, me and my brother did it together. And it was a really surprising 7 days. A lot of things happened that I didn't expect would happen. First and foremost, the depth of relationship that I had with my brother was deeper in that 7 days than it was like the 27 years prior, because our lives were so wretchedly miserable, we were forced to depend on ourselves like we never had before. I mean, it was like Paul and Silas in the jail, you know, singing hymns, even though life was miserable. So I would call him up like every half hour and say, "You did this to me, I can't stand this, I'm out, I'm tapping." And he'd be like, "No, Brother Ryan, stand strong." And then a half hour later, we'd switch roles, and we did that for 7 days. So there was a relationship there, but I also, jokes aside, I felt like I started to develop superpowers on this cleanse, because for the first 3 days, you have a low-grade headache, and you just want to die and take everybody around you with you, but after that, weird things start happening, and I noticed my eyesight improved to the point that it was like seeing a whole new world. "Don't you dare close your eyes," to quote a Disney princess on Sunday morning. I believe that might have been Aladdin, actually. I think he sang that song, Magic Carpet Ride. Right. I've seen a few Disney movies, and I got two kids running around. But the point is, I walked outside, and I could see colors more vividly than ever before in my life. My wife has always told me that I'm colorblind, and I think I am, but I wasn't for that cleanse. And even like the sharpness of, like I was looking at trees and it was just amazing to stare at a tree and you have literally nothing else to do in the middle of a juice cleanse. So I stared at a tree or two. And my brother said the same thing happened for him, but it was his smell. Like his sense of smell was 10 out of 10, crazy. So we did this for 7 days and the first time I did it, it was real beneficial because I felt like I wrapped my head around what juices I could and could not drink. Because some of them, man, like I almost saw twice, if you know what I'm saying. So after doing this in 2016, I was like, all right, I got this. I did it again in 2017 with my wife, and I thought, man, this is going to be cake. I've already done this. You know, this is old hat. Man, in 2017, it was so much worse. It was horrible. Nothing like I imagined, and I realized what I did. You can't have two adults in the same house doing a juice cleanse at the same time. For real, for real. Because that misery is like 2 plus 2 equals 30. Because I'm a melancholy. I got high highs, but man, I got some low lows. And you can't, you know, especially when two people are trying to take care of the kids, it just doesn't work that way. You got to have an off-site brother or sister that, you know, you actually, anyway. So I did this for 7 days. And people would throw rocks at me through this juice cleanse, which I'm a little bit hurt by. And so I'm going to talk to my church family about this group counseling session now. What people told me was that I was wasting my time with my juice cleanse because they said, Ryan, you're just losing water weight and you're going to gain it all back as soon as you have a carb again. But what those fools didn't realize, yeah, hit them back. What those fools didn't realize was that I never did the juice cleanse for the weight loss, because it is true you gain all the weight back the moment you have like a saltine after that thing. But that's not why I did the cleanse. So I did the cleanse. I did the cleanse because something even more remarkable than a good relationship with your brother or keen eyesight happens over those 7 days. Namely, it resets your appetite. As sure as I'm standing here, I remember day 4 talking to my brother about it. All we wanted in the middle of this juice cleanse, we didn't want to break it with like McDonald's or Burger King, which, you know, full disclosure, I can put a hurtin' on McDonald's or Burger King. I'm just saying. You can judge me, but my identity is in Christ, all right? But like halfway through that juice cleanse, the thought of fast food was nauseating to me. All I wanted was like a grilled chicken breast, skinless even, and like a cucumber, and for real, and maybe like a Caesar salad, but you know, light on the dressing, maybe oil and vinegar this time, I don't know, which wouldn't really be a Caesar, but you get what I'm saying. It really blew me away. So what happened over the span of that 7 days is that it reset my appetite to the point that I desired that which was good for me. And that's ultimately the most beneficial part of the cleanse. It's not what happens in the 7 days. It's the trajectory that's set after it. And really, when you look at America that is experiencing in every way, shape, and form an obesity epidemic, the problem with people is not that they eat things that are bad for them. That's just a symptom of the disease. The disease that you need to get at is that we desire things that are bad for us. And spiritually, it's no different. Spiritually, our biggest problem is not just that we do things that are bad, it's that we go after, we desire that which robs us of life rather than gives us life. So let me read something with that idea in mind. This is a really sobering verse. It's from James chapter 1, it's verses 14 to 15. Listen to this. It says, "Each person is tempted when he is drawn away and enticed by his own evil desires." Drawn away by your own evil desires. It says, "Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, it gives birth to death." That's a powerful verse, because it tells us something pretty crazy about ourselves. Namely, we're not free. You are not free. And let me tell you something that might blow your mind. In your entire life, you have never done what you want to do. Never. You have only ever done what your desires have led you to do, and those are not the same thing. They're not the same thing, because if you read Romans chapter 7, that's the chapter where it seems like the Apostle Paul just lost his mind. He's got this inner monologue. He sounds like he's got spiritual schizophrenia. And what he says is, man, I do the things that I don't want to do, and I don't do the things that I want to do. And that whole chapter is Paul coming to this realization and showing us he's not in control, and you're not in control, and I'm not in control. We are slaves to our own desires. The only question is, are your desires leading you to life or death? That's it. And what the Bible says is that in and of our natural state, we are born with desires that, if unchecked and unchanged, are going to lead us squarely to death. But what Jesus is saying here is that he can interrupt that trajectory and set a new trajectory for our lives, where our desires are so radically different and so aligned with God's desires that we're asking him for that which is already his will, and so we have what we ask for. It's an amazing promise that Jesus is making here. It's not consigning us to a life of never doing that which we want to do. He's talking about a new life with new desires. And Jesus isn't talking about dumbing our desires down either. He's talking about heightening them. A guy named C.S. Lewis put it this way. I love this quote. He said, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak." He said, "We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink, sex, and ambition, when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he can't imagine what's meant by the offer of a holiday at sea." And he ends it this way. He says, "We are far too easily pleased, And C.S. Lewis is exactly right. See, our problem isn't that we have these ridiculously refined appetites for sin. No, no. Our problem is that we settle for that which is so far inferior to what a loving Father has for us. Sin has dumbed our desires down. It hasn't heightened them. And what Jesus is saying here is that when he collides with you and you connect to him, one of the surefire byproducts of a relationship with Jesus is it's a process, it's not an overnight thing, but he changes your desires until you begin to desire that which is satisfying, that which is life-giving, that which is what is really meant to nurture your soul. And as we go to God with those desires, we find our heart's desire in God because he's giving us what we ask for as we ask for his will. And what it all leads to, where this all culminates, is my third and final idea this morning. It's that the true vine produces complete joy in us. Because here's how Jesus concludes here. In verse 11, he said, I have spoken these things to you. Here's why Jesus has spoken these things to us. He says, so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. That's Jesus' whole goal here. That's his whole motive from his own mouth. Why did he give this discourse? Why has he promised to be the true vine to give us joy unlike we've ever had before, complete joy? And the fact that Jesus is here talking about, you know, referencing a complete joy means that there must be, by antithesis, incomplete forms of joy, and there are. There's all kinds of joy that is incomplete, joy that rests on our circumstances, joy that rests on how people treat us, joy that rests on whether or not my expectations have been fulfilled and things worked out the way that I planned. That kind of joy is fading. That kind of joy comes and goes because it's an incomplete joy. What Jesus is talking about here is a complete joy that goes above and beyond the twists and turns and the heights and depths of life. It's a joy that's never threatened by what happens day to day because it depends on him and not us or the people and things around us. And the fact that Jesus calls himself a vine here means that wherever you are in life, if you're on the mountain, if you're in the valley, if you're in a dry and weary place, if you feel trapped, if you're not where you want to be, regardless of where you are, you can connect to this vine. And in connecting to this vine, it means wherever you are right now, Jesus can produce this kind of life in you, where deep change takes place in your life, where right desires get realigned in your life, and complete joy is the end result in your life wherever you are. And the reason is because God's people, God's children, hey, we're not products of our past. We're not products of our environment, of our home life, of the way that people treat us. We're products of the true vine. And wherever we are, the true vine can produce life in us. And so I want to end this teaching just by inviting anybody who wants to respond to this teaching to come on up and respond to it. I'm going to call the elders forward now, and I just want to ask you, listen, if you're here and you know that you want these things because you don't have them, if there's any doubt in your mind about what God would say to you if you stood before him, if you're not positive that you've ever made the personal decision to connect to this true vine, I just want to invite you to come on up and talk to one of these men and pray and get right today, because today you can connect to this vine. And I hope you do, because if you, during this last song, If you come up this morning and make the personal decision to connect to the true vine, a process will begin in your life today. A life-giving process will begin in your life today where deep change in which you please God and breathe life to the people around you will take place as Jesus changes you. Your desires will be realigned where no longer do you pursue that which is bad, but he can change you to pursue that which is good, and ultimately you'll experience joy like you've never experienced before. But the decision is yours. You have got to connect to this vine, and I hope you do. That's it. That's all.